We're going to spend the final hour of today's program discussing interfaith marriages. It's fairly common and pretty acceptable at this point for two people of different religions to marry, but many couples find some surprising problems come up. For instance, if neither the man or the woman practices their religion, if they have children, they may still want to bring their children up within the structure of a religion. So which one or which combination of the two do they use? Of course, if both partners are religious, the problems are more obvious. With me is Evelyn Kay, who has been in an interfaith marriage for 17 years. She grew up in a Jewish family, her husband in a Methodist family. They have two children of their own. Evelyn has written a book on interfaith marriage called Cross Currents: Children, Families, and Religion. She's also, by the way, a co-founder of Action for Children's Television. With me also is Reverend Ralph Moore and Rabbi Meir Seligman, who join us from time to time on Fresh Air to discuss religious philosophy and custom. Now, they've both presided over interfaith ceremonies, marriage ceremonies. As a matter of fact, they've worked together on two interfaith marriage ceremonies. Ralph Moore is the director of the Christian Association on the University of Pennsylvania campus. He's a minister of the Episcopal faith. Meir is a rabbi at the Reformed Temple Shalom in Broomall, Pennsylvania. Welcome, all of you, to Fresh Air. Evelyn, I'd like to start with you. Why did you write this book?
For two reasons. One, I was very curious to find out what had happened to other people who had got involved in interfaith marriages the way I had. And secondly, I didn't really believe all the terrible things people told me would happen to me when I married my husband, and he wasn't Jewish, and they hadn't happened yet. So it seemed to me it would be nice to find out if they had happened to other people. And so I went around the country and spoke to hundreds of other families in interfaith situations just to find out what really happened after the Jew married the Catholic and the Baptist married the Protestant.
So what happened?
I found out that most of the dire stories were not true. Interfaith marriages do not appear to be divorced 100 times more than anywhere else. Some of them fall apart, some of them last. I found out that some couples find the solution in picking one faith and deciding that they will follow one partner's faith. Some of them decide to join no group and perhaps create ceremonies within their family. And some of them decide to join both churches and groups. For example, the Lutheran Jewish family I met, where the husband and wife took their young son for a special welcoming ceremony in the Lutheran church. And at the same time, the wife lights candles on Friday night and they have a Passover Seder at the church and celebrate Christmas with her family. And the mingling of both faiths is absolutely total.
Are you or your husband religious?
We have feelings about sharing our traditions and our beliefs with our children, though we haven't ever joined any religious organization. We celebrate family services at home. We light candles for Hanukkah, and we tell our children the story of why we do that. We also have a family Christmas with a tree. We've had a Passover Seder with friends, both Jewish and non-Jewish. And we share with them our feelings that we often think that organized religion, taken to its extreme form, can be the most irreligious aspect of life there is, that it's totally lost sight of the reason that people often begin feeling religious when it becomes so extreme that you forget people are people in the end.
Were there points within your marriage that surprised you in terms of conflicts that came up that you didn't expect?
I think the worst conflict was before the marriage, and many other couples I spoke to said that the reason they feel their marriages survived was because they sorted out a great deal of the conflicts before they finally married. We had a great deal of opposition from my family and at first from my husband's family, who certainly didn't want him marrying a Jewish girl. Then because of those conflicts, we had to sit down and ask each other, how much does it mean to you? Do you believe in Jesus? Do you want to go to church? Do you want to keep a kosher home? How do you feel about these things? And because of those conflicts from family before we married, we were forced to sit down and say, well, how are we really going to bring up our children? Is it really going to bother you if I refuse to let our son be baptized? Or how do you feel about a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah? And those things we did talk through before we married. After we married, I don't think we've ever had an argument or a real crisis about religion that we haven't seen coming and in some way talked through before anything happened. Because we had sorted it out beforehand. And many of the couples I spoke to told me of having quite angry discussions before marriage when they would say, well, you're a so-and-so, so you believe this. And the other partner would say, I don't believe that. Why do you say that about me? And at that stage, they would try to understand what compromises they could make.
Let me introduce Ralph Moore and Mayor Seligman into this conversation. Ralph, when someone comes to you, either an individual or both members of a couple, and they're either embarking on or considering embarking on an interfaith marriage, and they're coming to you for some counseling, what things might you talk with them about?
I try to make it as hard on them as I can. Because some of the difficulties that Evelyn has pointed to in the book certainly are common experiences for a lot of couples that I've known. And they tend to treat clergy like yellow pages, plumbers and electricians and other figures that you just let your finger do the walking. We've scheduled our wedding for next month, and we want you to do the wedding or something such as that. So I make it really tough. The question is, why me? Why any religious figure? What is all that supposed to mean for you? What is it that you're... What complicity are you asking me to join, religiously speaking? And that's not true. That's true not only for anyone coming with a Jewish background, to me, an Episcopal priest, but I ask that right across the board of any of them, because...
You mean, why aren't you going to a judge?
Yeah, or go out
and... Live with each other.
Live with each other, precisely. Which means to me that my one primary function that I serve as a figure of that represents a tradition is that I should bring up the tradition first. Now, I'm not a stickler for detail, as you know, and as we'll discuss in a minute, because I then, after going through a lot of that, and by the way, a lot of people don't come back or, you know, just go away. Well, I don't want that kind of process. But when people then do like to come into a process of exploring that, then the next thing I say is, well, you're going to write your own service or something like that. And what do you mean, you know? Sometimes the replies are very bewildered.
Would you say this to two people of the same faith who came to you? Would you put them through the same questioning?
Absolutely.
Oh, great. Because
absolutely.
A couple of people in the same faith have said that they never, ever discussed religion because they assumed the other partner knew because they happened to come from the same religious
family. Even within the Episcopal Church, if a couple's... I do a lot of weddings on the campus. Most of the things that I do are people related to that particular campus area. And... when they come in and they're Episcopal students who happen to be involved in some campus activity, rather than go to the rector of the parish, it's really, I've arranged it with him that sometimes they'll come to me and ask to do the service. I have the same approach. No, it's not going to bring the prayer book out and recite it. Why do that? That means nothing in terms of the contract or the celebration. And we're permitted to really... throw the prayer book away and start from scratch, really.
That's great.
Mayor, are you going to be tough on the individual or the couple who comes to you asking you to marry them in an interfaith marriage?
Well, let me begin by saying that I operate with the premise that all marriages are intermarriages. So it makes absolutely no difference whether the two people who come into my office are of the same faith or of a different faith, because intermarriage is a function of mental health and personality coming together or not coming together, where religions generally make very little difference unless they want to make a difference out of them, and then it's a smokescreen. So generally, the other premise I operate with is that God has given us the right to choose how we wish to live our life and the right to choose the person we think will be good for us. So when a couple will come into my office, and I have the same thing that Ralph does, you know, can you be at such and such a place on such and such a time? And I said, I don't make weddings for dates or places. I share in weddings with people, and if you want to talk with me about that, I'll meet with you. And then when I meet with them, and just as Ralph does, I will treat that couple, whether they are interfaith or not, I'll treat all couples the same way. And what I will look for will be, how do they relate with each other one-on-one? My favorite question is, what do you like the least about each other? And before they have a chance to say anything, the way I have my seats positioned in my office, if they throw furtive glances toward each other, or they were facing each other and they suddenly turn away, then I know I've got something to deal with that has very little to do with anything else other than the fact that they haven't communicated. but then I'm very accepting of the choice that they have made, and I will build on a relationship, because if I'm going to share in their wedding, I am not a functionary. I want to be there in a way that makes me feel good and makes them feel good, and the sky's the limit, so to speak, as to how they want to put the ceremony right. together.
Evelyn, in your interviews with people who are in interfaith marriages, was it hard for them to find someone who they liked and who they respected to marry them?
Yes, the two gentlemen here today are unusual in the sense that very few people who I interviewed had managed to find them. I heard very sad stories of calling up the rabbi and saying, we want to get married. And as soon as he heard it was an interfaith marriage, he'd say, I want nothing to do with that. And of Catholic priests who would say, well, as long as she comes to classes and it takes these special classes and then converts, then I'm happy to marry you in the church. And one lovely story where the Episcopal woman went with her Catholic husband to be to see her priest, and he suggested that perhaps they both might like to join the United Church of Christ or some other less demanding faith and give up their faith and take something quite new. And she was very shocked by this because she didn't feel she could switch off her religion and take another label. It's hard. It's not as hard as it was, but it's still hard to find sympathetic clergy to understand that the differences are not just the labels. The differences are two people who have found each other and who may have problems in the relationship, but these are not just the religious differences that are between them. In fact, one woman told me the real problem in her marriage was that he was a man and she was a woman, and they could never solve that one.
Well, that's as old as we can remember, isn't it? One thing about your book that I found really rewarding is the way you open up in one or two of the chapters the idea of people kind of discovering their own spirituality along in the process. And that is my ideal of the beginning of this thing when people come in for this to talk about the wedding. The hope is that we can put our fingers on those elements which really are at the center of themselves as people. Whether it's an ethical idea or a philosophical thought or a real sense of spirituality, whatever it is, and however they want to choose symbolic representation of it, it's supposed to be something that then can be looked upon as ongoing support for them, energy-producing vitality after they're married, you know. And so we want the celebration to really be real in that sense. And I like the way you suggest that really is a very, very wonderful new way that some people are discovering.
I think some of the things people told me were really very exciting, and I was, you know, very honored that they shared some of these things with me. Because if people choose to go to a religious leader, then they have feelings that they don't want crushed. I had a civil ceremony. I didn't go to a religious leader. I'm not sure we could have found one then. But because I had been deterred by the opposition.
Sure.
But people who do go and seek out a religious leader are asking for help. And I think you're absolutely right. If you can somehow tap that feeling they have and direct it into their marriage, it can be very positive.
But Evelyn, how did the people make the decision, like, which religious, which representative of which religion they wanted to go to for the wedding ceremony?
It's very haphazard. There's a rabbi in Westfield, New Jersey, who provides a list of rabbis who will perform interfaith marriages. And the only other way is by word of mouth of, you know, which priest will do it, which minister is interested. And the minister at the United Nations Church Center, whose ceremonies I use in the end of the book, certainly performs interfaith ceremonies. And at the United Nations, I'm sure something that he always did.
Mayor, why will most rabbis say, no, interfaith marriage, I won't touch that?
I think that most rabbis perceive themselves as preservers of the faith rather than perpetuators of it. It may be a hair-splitting distinction, but for me it's very significant. I think that what we are experiencing in America with interfaith weddings is a breakthrough on the part of human beings to a new sense of universality and particularity. So that anything new, most people respond to in fear. Most clergymen who perceive themselves as obligated to preserve the faith as it has been generally don't see novelty, mutation, change, and a concept of a developmental process as part of the faith. So as a result of that, that's one of the reasons why they won't do it. Another reason is that they have thought for a long time, prejudgedly, that interfaith weddings would lead to the demise of Judaism, that the Jewish partner would be lost to the faith, and that the children issued from that interfaith marriage would be lost to Judaism, both of which I have felt all along was hogwash. But, you know, the usual kind of defensive posture within the Jewish community understandably brought that to be. Now most of the major Jewish organizations who are not directly accepting intermarriages are very directly encouraging that the intermarried couples be treated warmly and lovingly and comfortably. As a matter of fact, it came to my attention during breakfast after Yom Kippur that a conservative rabbi in a very traditional congregation for Yom Kippur bawled the congregation out for not accepting intermarried couples into the family. Now, shades of transmutation. 10 years ago, you ain't never going to see anything like that, and that's within the framework of conservative Judaism. Reform, I might add, which for me is a totally different breed of Judaism, thank God, has always accepted people who wanted to become part of Judaism into the fold, and interfaith couples where the mother was not Jewish, the child is considered Jewish by Reform Judaism if the child is raised within the framework of a Reform congregation.
That's a radical move because
it's quite old.
The major opposition and the criticism I got from most of the rabbis I spoke to is that if the mother isn't Jewish, the child isn't Jewish, which is the traditional Jewish definition of a Jew.
You know why that is, Evelyn?
Well, and I don't...
Because if
what
a,
level.
Why the child followed the lineage of the mother?
No.
Because in the medieval world, when women, Jewish women were carried away captive and either cohabited with a non-Jew or were raped and conceived, when they were ransomed and came back to the Jewish community, did you think that the practical Jews would consider the kids illegitimate and not Jewish? That's where that whole notion emerged.
I thought it was older than that. I thought it went back to biblical days. I didn't know it was as new as medieval times.
Recall anything specifically biblical, though, that would relate to that.
I'm wondering how acceptable you think it is at this point amongst families and amongst communities for people who are in interfaith marriage.
Of course, in terms of the Jewish question, the Jewish perspective of it, I certainly can't quarrel with the sensitivity of the issue. And so I don't know, I'm always looking to Mayer and other friends in the Jewish community to give me feedback about that. But of course, with Protestants, I'm pretty typical. I had a Disciples of Christ mother and a Southern Baptist father and was baptized a Methodist, grew up a Presbyterian, became originally ordained in the United Church of Christ, and now Episcopalian.
A rainbow, yes.
That's right. And I'm not very atypical. I mean, Protestants really move back and forth. And it always turns out what's the show look like in the local community and who's doing it is how we pick and choose.
Was told of people who went around shopping for churches that they would attend different churches every week and decide which one they wanted to go to.
It's the American way.
They shop for synagogues.
They do too?
Sure, right around high holiday time. It's shopping time. By all means. I think it's very good.
So within that framework, I can record that within Protestants, the moving back and forth in terms of marriage is not really a major concern. We were married in the Moravian church, which is my wife's background. But I was brought up to really fear Catholics like crazy. And it's only been in the last few years that that question of Protestant Catholics has been more acceptable among Protestants. We realize that Catholics are not, you know, agents of a foreign power or all of those other bugaboos that we were thought to exist.
Ralph, how much nervousness is there in a family, for instance, about an intermarriage between a Catholic and a Protestant?
Well,
is that
like
the kind
I say,
of thing that will get the couple's parents very upset?
If the parents are from an older form of Catholicism, pre-Vatican II and all that, yes, it really does present enormous problems. And there is an authority question, and there's in terms of how, you know, a priest and the authority and the legality of the wedding and the validity of that whole procedure. And then the children raise enormous problems.
I have a lovely story about that where this
Catholic
woman married a young Baptist who wanted to be a Baptist minister, and he decided that the two of them could share their faiths, and his parents objected because she was Catholic and her parents objected because he wasn't Catholic, but they did get married in a Catholic church and they agreed they would share both their faiths. So she has a baby. Catholics believe you have to baptize a baby very soon, weeks, months. Baptists believe you must never baptize a baby,
yes,
because baptism is an adult decision of commitment to the faith, and you only baptize adults. So they had this incredible dilemma, and he spent months looking it up in textbooks and talking to Catholic priests and talking to ministers, and finally they created this service in their Baptist church, whereby a Catholic priest came into a Sunday morning service, and they had a baby bath, like a bath, not a sprinkling, and the Catholic priest dunked the baby in the baby bath to christen her during the Baptist service. One member did quit the congregation in disgust, but they felt they had brought their two faiths to a ceremony like this in a way that had never been done before.
I might add that we have had an Episcopalian priest who has been married, who's married to a Jewish woman in our congregation for a number of years. They're raising their sons as Jewish, and they have been welcome to our congregation. Although they are no longer affiliated, they come back very often to attend many of our services.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to tell another story about that was from the last service that Mayer and I did together. It was at Temple Shalom. Afterwards, at the big reception and dinner, I was seated at a table, and everyone there was from the Jewish side of the family, and they were all Romanian Jews from the Bronx, and they were all very different look from myself, you know, and I was nervous. I just didn't know how this whole thing went over and so forth, and I sat down, and we began eating. And it was just marvelous. After a minute of chit-chat, they just started talking about how wonderful this was, and they just glowed. They were just really appreciative of the fact that I, as a priest, had done this thing, and that more of this ought to happen. And I really, you know, this isn't not solicited.
Absolutely.
I was really expecting something quite different from that. Now, I don't know how widespread that kind of feeling is.
I think it's the reality. What I found is that people are very terrified of Jews are terrified of meeting non-Jews, and Catholics are terribly worried about what Protestants are really like. And we all go around with these stereotype images in our heads of what they must be like once we get to meet them, with a capital T. And what happens when two young people meet and fall in love is that they find out that they are very much like us, and what's more, that they love each other. But for the parents, it's very hard to understand that until they meet. And I would think seeing you and seeing the service was probably mind-blowing for them. And you didn't have horns, and you didn't scream, and you didn't talk in Latin. I mean, the whole thing must have been a real revelation for them.
Evelyn, it's the Jews who have horns.
I always get that wrong.
God, how the world has changed.
Let me reintroduce everybody for our listeners who are just joining us. We're talking about interfaith religion. And just speaking was Evelyn Kay, and she's written a very interesting new book called Cross Currents, Children, Families, and Religion. And she's traveled around interviewing a lot of different people who have interfaith marriages and talking to them about how the marriage worked out, how they brought up their children. She herself has been in an interfaith marriage for about 17 years. Speaking before her was Reverend Ralph Moore. Now, Ralph is the director of the Christian Association on the Penn campus. He's an Episcopal priest. With me also is Mayor Seligman, who is a Reformed rabbi at Temple Shalom in Broomall, Pennsylvania. And Ralph and Mayor have joined us a number of times in the past to discuss different religious questions and issues. Well, you brought up parents, so let's get right on to the question of parents. You've all mentioned before the interview started that that's really where a lot of the difficulties lay. In what way, Evelyn, in your interviews, were when the couple themselves were working things out, were they having a lot of interference on the part of their parents?
Yeah, that is one of the real crucial issues that can ruin an interfaith marriage. It's very hard for a couple who are trying to sort out their feelings and their beliefs and come to some understanding to cope when on one side one group of parents is saying, don't do it, it's the end of the world, you must never marry him or she will drag you down and we will lose our grandchildren, which is a very real fear of many of the parents, that you know we will lose our grandchildren, they won't belong to us because you've gone with him or you've gone with her. And after the marriage, it doesn't go away, which is something almost all the couples I spoke to emphasized. In one case where this young couple met in music school and they were very much in love and they had a great deal in common. In fact, today they play piano duets together. She was from an Episcopal family and he was Jewish. they decided that she wouldn't convert, but she agreed to bring the children up as Jews. And his family welcomed her because they thought she was just delightful and they loved the way they shared music together. Her family were appalled and objected to the marriage and didn't come to the wedding. And finally, after several years, she converted to Judaism. And her parents have never accepted that, never even believed she would do it. And her parents, her mother still calls her up and asks her when she's going to baptize her children, the eldest of whom has had a bar mitzvah, and the next is 11, and the next is 5. And one evening when they were visiting, it was the first night of Hanukkah, and she decided she couldn't face the confrontation if she lit the Hanukkah lights with them there. So she told her children and her husband, "Would you mind very much if we just wait till tomorrow when they're leaving? And we'll light the Hanukkah lights on the second light a night," because she knew that the disapproval and the anger after all these years would still be there. And that's a very real problem if people are attached to their parents very strongly, that interference will still be there.
Mayor, you were telling me that you spend a lot of time counseling the parents of the children who are about to have the interfaith marriage.
Yes, if I make a commitment to share in a couple's wedding, then I extend an invitation to both sets of parents to come in and meet with me. Because generally what I find is what a couple is able to handle very comfortably, families flip out over. And I mentioned before we went on the air that there was a man, a psychologist, whose wedding I officiated at, must be 5 or 6 years ago. And his wife did not convert to Judaism. They are raising their children as Jews. And around Christmas time every year, I get a call from him. And he said, "Mayor, my parents are driving me crazy. They are saying that my wife is secretly teaching Christianity to my children, and that it is done especially at this time." And I said to this psychologist, I said, "Your parents are nuts." And he said, "I know that, but that doesn't help me with my guilt." And he said, "You know, we come to your congregation, we attend services," and I said, "Tell your folks to call me." And of course they won't, because they know what I will tell them. Parents, along the lines of what you said, Evelyn, I think that if you are brand X and you suddenly bring in brand Y that you're going to marry, the first feeling on a psychological level is discontinuity. So therefore, make my grandchildren X's, and I'll be able to handle this blippy Y that you brought into the family. Parents really need a great deal of support, a great deal of understanding, and an environment where they can express what their feelings are. I have another wedding coming up where the parents are enormously angry at their son, a Jewish family, because the son has decided not to have Jewish symbols and rituals because he does not feel that they are appropriate. So they are yelling and bawling him out for him not giving them what they want. I said, "They're children. Who's getting married? What kind of expectations are you placing on your son? It's his day. It's not your day."
Mayor, are you ever successful in getting the parents to just ease off their children?
Yes. My favorite line is that if you're not committed to your child, you're not Jewish.
My education in this matter came with my own wedding, which my mother almost refused to attend. And you see, it's not a matter of the fact that Congregationalist, happened to be marrying in the Moravian church. It was the fact that, well, when she finally did come from California, she sat there and realized that we weren't using the wedding march and we weren't using all these other things. And of course, her life was built upon all of these expectations. I couldn't feel a lot of sympathy with her at the time, but I have gone through that so many times since then with people who have. It's an extension of myself to see this through with my children.
It's a tradition. We have to, matter how absurd the tradition. I mean, playing the wedding march is not a biblical tradition, but it's a tradition, and therefore, if you balk that tradition, you know, you are changing the world.
And we served communion. Well, that just flipped her out terribly. That's a little bit too religious, isn't it? You know? And things like that.
Do you counsel parents now?
I have from time to time, I remember the last couple we worked with, Mayor. I was terribly gratified by the way you were dealing with that one in particular, because there was a little bit of fright and fear on the Jewish side, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
See, parents have this great way of creating loyalty conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you really love?
Right.
And I suspect that, by the way, I would say in a generic way, all parents intrude into the newly established relationship of couples who are planning on getting married. And the loyalty conflict, I think, is a generic reality. And when you add, say, let's say, the intermarriage possibility, it magnifies it significantly.
Well, there's the traditional dinner tally. You went to their house for dinner five times,
and you've only come here twice. That's an example
of the loyalty conflict, yes, completely removed from any religious question.
I think, I mean, the problems in an interfaith marriage and an interfaith family when children come are only the problems of marriage.
Precisely.
If you can't stand him because he yawns loudly in the morning and he can't stand you because you don't put the top on the toothpaste, that has nothing to do with religion. However, the sensitivities are a little sharpened because if you have married across religious lines, and this was something you talked about, that there's a little tiny edge to it, which can make it a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. I suspect that the only time religion makes a difference in an intermarriage is if one of the partners feels vulnerable when zapped by the fact, well, if you weren't Zen Buddhist or you weren't Lao Tse, this would not happen. And it's all smokescreen. It's not a real issue.
Yeah, I also think, I mean, in our family, we certainly have a standing joke that when anybody meets my husband, they assume he's the one who's Jewish, and they'll take him aside and chat to him, and they assume I'm the one who's not. And so this is a standing joke in our house. That's the way it really is, and we just don't want to tell anyone.
I early on bring this subject up at the first meeting when couples come to me. What about the parents? How do they feel? And what are their expectations? And a lot of them hadn't thought of it.
Yeah.
I can't believe it, but I even get into the fact, how do you want me to look? What do you think they think I should be wearing at this thing? And they hadn't even plumbed that deeply. But it starts to get into stuff when you realize, well, they want you to look like a priest, or no, we don't want any specific religion there at all, or, you know, it starts to come out because
come
they
in
have,
Bermudas. Yeah.
Haven't done that yet, but... Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about ceremonies. Now, Ralph, you mentioned that you and Mayer have held joint ceremonies together for intermarriages. What type of ceremony was that? How did you map it out? What kind of vows were there?
In each of those, we had the couples work their own vows into shape. And so that was their business, we did all decided. We all consulted.
Did you mention Jesus? Mayer,
right off the bat, in both cases, said that he would not be offended if Jesus were mentioned.
Because that's often the big issue in some of them.
And I make no particular requirement that Jesus be mentioned. Mm. So they had to make their own decision about that in both cases. And in each case, I think, Mayer and I performed some specific religious piece out of our particular understanding of what would be appropriate for this person, kind of since we had gotten into it on that real growing edge with the person. And in each case, I think, if I remember correctly, they chose a chuppah, yes, and the cup and some specific things out of Jewish background. And I gave a blessing or a prayer, and we read some Christian scripture or something such as that.
I think it was a candle lighting ceremony.
It was a candle lighting ceremony.
Yeah. Did each person in both these ceremonies want to stay in their faith and want to have some connection to their religion aside from the fact that they were born into it?
The first one, I don't think there was that much of a quality, but they wanted they really felt it would be meaningful to have the representatives of the tradition and the tradition expressed. They are both, I'm speaking of Janet and Peter, they're both working together, wonderful life together, very spiritual couple. Mm-hmm. Neither is practicing within either of the specific traditions, but I would consider them to be having a very interesting religious life.
Yeah.
Some people find the solution by going to something like the Unitarian Universalist Association, mm-hmm, which is an extremely liberal church. And the one minister I spoke to said that he always encourages couples to write their own ceremony. And if they're absolutely devoid of imagination, he gives them a kind of outline, mm-hmm, and some suggestions. But he says he always encourages them to create the ceremony and to bring in something from their background, because he feels otherwise it won't mean anything to them at all.
Well, Evelyn, you have a whole appendix of ceremonies that people have used. Give us some samples of creative ceremonies.
There are two interfaith marriage ceremonies. I didn't know these two gentlemen had created some already, from the United Nations Church Center in New York. Reverend Melvin Hawthorne has written an interdenominational interfaith ceremony, And also there's a Jewish Catholic ceremony which brings in prayers from the Catholic marriage ceremony and from the Jewish ceremony. There's some Hebrew in it, and there's this, the wine and the breaking of the cup. Those a part of it as well. There's also a ceremony that the Lutheran Jewish couple wrote for their son. The son was given a ritual circumcision by a Jewish mohel and a family party. And a few months later, he was taken to the Lutheran church, and they didn't want him baptized. They didn't feel comfortable with that. So they had a special welcoming ceremony when he was welcomed as a member of the Lutheran church, and that he should be free to come there at any time. And he was welcomed as a Jewish child coming into the Lutheran church, which was very unusual. And I had a couple of ceremonies for 13-year-olds, which the Creative Initiative Group wrote, which is a kind of sect in California, whereby the boys are welcomed into manhood and the girls are welcomed into womanhood, with where they have to study certain topics in the Bible. Those aren't in the appendix, they're in part of the book. But those are ceremonies people created because they wanted them to mark the kind of life they'd chosen to follow, even though it wasn't a traditional religion.
Evelyn, before, when Ralph was explaining the ceremony that he and Mayer led together, you said, well, Jesus is usually the bone of contention, whether or not Jesus is going to be mentioned in the ceremony. Apparently, you've come across incidents like that where that was the key question. Why is that such a heavy thing for people?
Well, for most Jews, Jesus is an unknown factor. I mean, you certainly don't study the life of Jesus in Hebrew school. And so they feel very threatened by this idea of Jesus being part of a service. This is what I have been told by many of them. And the use of his name or invoking his blessings is somehow very threatening within the context of an interfaith service where there are Jews present. Young couples who have, or other couples who have worked through this and have understood Jesus in a sense not as just a token of being Christian and them, can accept it. But for some of them, it's a very sensitive issue, and they feel very uncomfortable with that kind of prayer being involved in the service they're taking part in. The Lutheran couple, in fact, the Jewish man, spent a great deal of time studying, as he called it, Christology, the whole concept of Jesus as Christ. And he found it very difficult to accept at the beginning, but the more he understood it, the more he realized why it was part of the Lutheran services.
Yeah, I would say within the context of encouraging couples to choose for themselves what they want, my goal is to affirm in a special way the commonality of God and the varying ways that God has provided to come to God, so that to bring the wealth and the richness of the multiple traditions to a wedding ceremony, because the couple wishes it that way, to me partakes of a transcendent goal. And I love doing that. So, you know, when Ralph and I have been together, the chuppah or the wine ceremony or the glass breaking, whatever the rituals are that give a sense of meaning, as Ralph said, to the souls of the two couples, I could only see God cavelling. I could only see God really being very, very happy that two of his children had chosen to come together to that risky enterprise called marriage and wanted to affirm their own religious identities and bring the richness of their traditions together.
One way out of this, one way out of bringing the richness of two traditions together, which can be complex, is to see to it that one of the two converts, and that although the couple may have been brought up in two different religions, if one of them converts, there you don't have to ask the question every day of which holiday you're going to celebrate that year, or what a birthright or rite of passage you're going to celebrate when the child comes of age. Evelyn, having interviewed a lot of people, was conversion a successful thing amongst many families?
Yes, if it was taken wholeheartedly. One of the nicest couples I met was this very cheerful woman who had been brought up as a Catholic in French-speaking Canada. And so her parents only wanted her to marry a French-speaking Canadian Catholic. She was a nurse, and she met this Jewish man through one of her patients who recommended that she should meet this young man. And she took him home to her parents, feeling she ought to, you know, let him be introduced. And they all went to Easter Sunday services. And the French-Canadian Catholic priest took it upon himself to preach one of these hellfire sermons that if the Jews hadn't killed Jesus, he would be here today. We must all remember who did it. And she saw her father sitting there, and the veins in his neck were getting redder and redder. And when they came out of the church, he took her aside and said, after that sermon, you become whatever he is, and you don't make him become what we are. And so she thought about it and told her husband she'd like to think about conversion, and she converted to Judaism. And she said it simplified a lot of problems for her. She's never really felt that she gave up her Catholicism. They visit her parents. There's a warm feeling from her family towards her husband and herself and their children. But she said in a lot of ways it made a decision for her, and it solved some of the problems she felt they might have had with the children. But you have to have that wholeheartedness to want to go into it to make it work, I think.
What advice would you give someone who's thinking of converting because of a marriage, Ralph? If it's something that wasn't really brought up before the marriage came along, if it wasn't something that had been contemplated,
I think
for 10
it has
years.
To be considered. I was just this brought me back to an experience of a very, very close friend of mine at St. Mary's Episcopal Church in West Philadelphia, who, when I was priest in charge while the rector was away one year, was my lay leader of the congregation. He was a faculty person at Penn, and what I would consider to be really one of the most interesting, trusted friends I had in the Episcopal Church. His wife was Jewish, and she would come to the worship services on Sunday and participate just minimally, but be there and be a part of the community, and we all loved her, and we considered that to be a very acceptable, wonderful enfolding of her. They had two children, and they kind of put the question off. They were trying to deal with it in terms of an interfaith question, and within a few days, Bob came into me one day and says, I've converted.
Wow.
And it swept me off my feet. I just didn't know how to respond to that, because I thought there, for those two people with so many intellectual options, that they might have found a lot of interesting varieties of experience. But Bob said, no, I just felt suddenly, that was what I just suddenly felt so comfortable doing that, and now we've got a lot of things worked out, and now they're moved out of the city, and I don't know how things are, but we still remain close friends, and they've come back for visits, and they still consider to be a part of St. Mary's family. But I still don't know how I would like to experience him
it
now.
What happened?
In this new way. I would not give any advice to anybody to convert. I would say it would be something that simply had to come from within. Conversion is an interior experience. It's certainly not something like a new suit of clothes that you can put on in any exterior way.
Mary, do you know people who've converted for a marriage?
Well, if people come to me very often, if they want a rabbi to do the ceremony, they say all the things that they think the rabbi wants to hear. And I told him, I'm not interested in hearing what I want to hear. I want to know them. I discouraged conversions at the outset. I said, I don't believe in quickies, that if you're thinking about something like that, that's fine. But do you accept each other as you are? Because that's the challenge of marriage. The challenge of marriage is not that you become in the image of the other person or the way the other person wants you, which is the hidden issue with marriage, at least initially, but that you accept each other as you are. I do not need you to convert in order for me to share in your wedding. I would discourage you from doing it if you're doing it to make me happy, to make your partner happy. But if you do want to talk about converting at a later time, I would be happy to discuss it with you. I also don't like the word conversion because you can't go from AC to DC. I see this, I think has already been expressed, it's a developmental process. You add on to who you were. You do not deny or rip out your past. I am much more worried about that kind of conversion than someone who comes along with it and moves into it as a kind of natural development in whichever way it would go.
I'd like to just reintroduce you for our listeners who are just tuning in. We're talking about interfaith marriages and families, and just speaking was Rabbi Meir Seligman, who's a Reform rabbi at the Temple Shalom in Broomall. With me also is Evelyn Kay, who has for 17 years and continues to have an interfaith marriage. She was brought up in a Jewish family. Her husband was brought up in a Methodist family. She's written a book on interfaith marriage called Cross Currents, Children, Families, and Religion. Also with me is Reverend Ralph Moore, who's the director of the Christian Association on the Penn campus and a minister of the Episcopal faith. Let's talk a little bit about children. Now, you've all alluded to how it's could be a very rich experience if all the different holidays of both religions are celebrated and discussed. Do you think that the children in an interfaith family grow up confused or grow up feeling like they're neither one nor the other faith, and they don't have that kind of grounding or identity that religion gives some people?
It depends on the parents. really, and how they share their faith with their children. The families I met who had been very honest and open with their children, the children didn't seem the least confused. One 16-year-old said, yeah, my mother's Jewish, my dad's not, and we celebrate some Jewish things, and we go to his family for Christmas. And there was no confusion about what was happening there because his parents had always been very honest with him about what was going on.
But what about the kid? If you said, what religion are you? What would he say?
Well, he said, I'm Jewish because my mother's Jewish, but I'm also half Christian because my father isn't Jewish. And that didn't seem to bother him. Generally, you feel he might fall in a faint on the floor and say, I don't know what I am. But he knew what he was. There really was no confusion in his head. And my own son says quite calmly he's half and half, and that way he gets Hanukkah and Christmas. He's absolutely certain about that.
What do you think your son's going to celebrate when I...
I have no idea. In this day and age, you're only thankful they get up and put their socks on every day. I'm living with two teenagers, and I trust we get through to 21. Teenagers will do what teenagers will do, and you can only give them the support and the love and the encouragement and hope that they will...
And the space to do what they have to do.
And you have to let them grow through it. Many of the people who have brought up their children in very strict faiths are appalled when they leave it and choose something else. Many parents who brought their children up very liberally are then equally shocked when their child goes off and becomes a Roman Catholic priest. I mean, you really can't do more than offer them the alternatives and be truthful and honest with them, give them some of the values you live by, which is, after all, the basis of religion, the values and the moral standards you choose to live by, and hope that in some way they're going to absorb them and carry some of them on.
Yeah, I would say confused parents create confused children, whether they are intermarried or not.
There's not much doubt about that. and I just really am experiencing this with our oldest son, who's second year in college, who considers himself a Taoist.
A what?
A Taoist. Taoism of China. The philosophy of Lao Tzu. Well, he's baptized and confirmed in the Episcopal Church, and actually has been working through a sense of Christian spirituality in getting his whole act together with regard to military service and his whole sense of his conscientious objectorship and that kind of business. And when he was back for vacation this summer, we all went to church together, and it was the first time the four of us had been at St. Mary's, gosh, in a long, long time. So he didn't come in and say, guess what, I'm a Taoist, in terms of repudiating Christianity. It's kind of like that's where he is right now, and I applaud that. It's a very wonderful philosophy. Actually, it is deeply spiritual in every the best sense of the word, and is totally consistent with my understanding of where Christianity takes us too. So I'm just happy that he's happy.
But it depends. That's very much your attitude. For some parents, it's very frightening. I mean, I spoke to a Jehovah's Witness family who were shocked at the idea that their child might celebrate Christmas because the Witnesses don't celebrate Christmas.
I noticed that story.
Or be invited to some Jewish celebration because the father said we couldn't possibly let him go because those aren't real ceremonies, those aren't real religious observances, and we couldn't let him take part in things like that. They would find it very hard for their child to move away from what they had brought him up in.
One important thing that comes to me from the book is how you've identified the relationship of religious backgrounds with the natural process of rite of passage. And I imagine we should go into that a lot more in the future years. I mean, you mentioned Piaget and some of the things coming out of that. What are the creative tools that all the traditions offer us as families in terms of how kids need to have concrete reaffirmation at some of these key points along the life? With my second son, it's confirmation in the Episcopal Church. Some other child might refuse that, but it would be something. They need something in the way of confirmation and affirmation from the parental side of things. And creatively speaking, the various religious faiths offer a lot of very wonderful traditions along those lines, if understood that way, if they could become a part of the fabric of the family breathing, so to speak.
We're running out of time, and I'd like to spend the remaining few minutes asking you what you think the implications of all of this are for the future. For instance, if there's a generation of children growing up within interfaith marriages who consider themselves to be half one religion and half the other, and if they in turn marry someone who is like themselves interfaith or someone who is of a specific faith, we're going to have a lot of people with mixed backgrounds asking themselves a question: how are they going to bring up their children, and how are they going to relate spiritually to their own lives, and what holidays will they celebrate?
I should sell a lot of books.
Mayor, what do you think this is going to mean in the future?
Well, I think part of the basic function will be how mentally healthy are the kids. And if they have a generally high degree of mental health, then they will be able to handle the tough kinds of decisions, I think, with a developmental kind of maturity. So I'm not really concerned about that. I think that what it will do will probably broaden the parameters of most religious faiths and make those who are clergy look very, very hard and deep into their own theologies and look very hard and deep in terms of their commitment to all of God's children and respond accordingly.
Ralph, do you want to add anything?
Can't say it any better than that. I think it just is going, we're in for a very creative period if it can be seen that way. I don't see anything to be afraid of.
Evelyn?
The only alternative to what you described would be to put everybody back into little ghettos and to forbid them to speak to each other. And because of the pattern of our life today, the ease of travel, the way people are meeting people from a far broader range of backgrounds than they ever did before, I don't think there's any way you can lock people behind bars again and say, you don't speak to them, they're not one of us. I think we're going to have to accept that this exchange of ideas and exchange of faith and beliefs across marriage lines is going to continue, because I really can't see how it's going to be stopped.
And what better way to know that we're all part of God's family?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to thank all of you for a very interesting conversation. Thanks so much for coming to Fresh Air. With me have been three people. Evelyn Kay has written a book called Cross Currents, Children, Families, and Religion, and that's based on interviews with numerous families who are involved with interfaith families. She herself is in an interfaith marriage. She grew up in a Jewish family. Her husband in a Methodist family. Mayor Seligman has been with us. He is a Reformed rabbi. He is with Temple Shalom in Broomall, Pennsylvania. And Ralph Moore has also been here. He is an Episcopal priest. He's the director of the Christian Association on the Penn campus. And Mayor and Ralph have joined us a number of times in the past on Fresh Air to discuss various religious questions. Well, I guess we didn't get to open up the telephone, so it really wasn't time. So my apologies if you were already at the telephone to call us up. Maybe we'll talk about this again another time.
Have them call their local priest or rabbi.